Thank you for listening to this Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. Now, before we get started, I just want to take a moment to thank Footman James for sponsoring Last Blast. As you know, at The Intercooler, we only partner with like-minded organisations, with companies that we think really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast. Footman James fit into that perfectly. I know this because when talking to them before making this recording, they said to me, please don't talk about car insurance, which I think says a lot. So instead, I'm just going to give you a couple of reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. Coffee and chrome, for one thing, that's Footman James' regular car meet. It's free to attend once you're registered, and it's where hundreds, if not a thousand, car enthusiasts get together with their classics to enjoy and share their passion for cars. Footman James also publishes its Indicator Report. It's a thorough analysis and a detailed report into the state of classic car ownership in this country. The point is to promote and safeguard the future of classic cars in the UK. So there you go, two good reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. So thank you, Footman James. Go and visit footmanjames.co.uk. You're listening to the Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a very special Last Blast podcast. You're joining me today at Donington Park, where I am with Sir Chris Hoy. Doing any kind of introduction seems somewhat redundant, given the person we're talking about. But Sir Chris, as you know, six-time Olympic gold medalist, 11 times world champion, London 2012. I mean, I don't know what it's like for you, but for us, just looking at it on television is one of the greatest sporting moments I think most people listening to this will ever have come across. And I think that, you know, everything that you achieved there in your career up to date is just outstanding. But we're actually not going to spend an awful lot of time talking about bicycles, because we're here to talk about road cars, racing cars, because that has been, would you call it a second career of yours, or is it a...
It's an obsession. It's not, I wouldn't call it a career, because that kind of makes it seem a bit grander than it really is. It's just, it was a passion that I had while I was still cycling, while I was competing on bikes. I used to do track days at the end of each cycling season. And then just the opportunity to take up motorsport came along, and it kind of grew legs. But it's not a career. I absolutely love it. It's a hobby. It's a passion. It's an obsession.
Wonderful. So before we start, there are three questions I have to ask you. And everybody gets asked the same three questions. First car, first crash, first race.
Okay. First car, well... Do you want the first car that I had to pay for with my own money, or the first car that I inherited from my parents?
I think the first car that you could say, looking in the mirror, was your car, however you came about it.
Well, yeah, okay. The first car I had was a Citroen Xantia.
Oh!
Which...
not with the active ride?
Yeah.
Which really?
Which was absolutely horrendous. So it had done about 130,000 miles by the time I inherited it. It was my parents' car. My dad had got a company car, so this was getting used for the odd run. My mum would pop to the supermarket in it, whatever.
Yeah.
And then, so I hadn't even got a driving license until I was about 20. And it was because I was based in Edinburgh, I was at university in Edinburgh, cycling everywhere. I couldn't afford a car, couldn't afford to run a car. But then the velodrome in Manchester opened up, and I was having to get from Edinburgh to Manchester twice a month. And that seemed the best way to get a driving license, to use this car to get up and down the M6.
Yeah.
And it was bloody awful. It was it was one of the days before mobile phones, or the days before I had a mobile phone, and you would check where the emergency telephones were on the motorway.
You'd mentally remember how far past the last one was.
Is it worth walking forwards or backwards to get to that phone to make that call? Because, the ride would just drop. The ride height would just, out of nowhere, would kind of come right down. And then you'd sort of try and jack it up and stop it, and it was broken. It wasn't how it was supposed to be, but it would just randomly change ride height to being like a big monster truck, jacked up or bouncing around low down. So, yeah, I mean, it got me there, and that was what got me from Edinburgh to Manchester and home. So I'm grateful in that respect, but it was a bit of a pig. But, yeah, I look back fondly now.
So, actually, if I suspect you're... first crash might be in a race, so maybe we do first race first.
First race, again, I could pick from two, really, because technically my first race was at the Formula One in Australia in 2013. I did a celebrity race in a Mazda diesel road car.
Right.
There was like a full grid of about 24 cars.
Yeah. Can you remember who else was on the grid?
It was all Australians. The guy, was a cricketer that won it. There was Holly Valance, who was in Neighbours.
Yeah,
She was in it. Loads of, who else was it? This has put me on the spot now. Like Australian chefs pop stars and TV stars and Neighbours stars.
Yeah.
And sport. Anna Mears was in it, who's an Olympic cyclist, double or triple Olympic champion. Real big star in track cycling. So it was very competitive, and I was competitive, and I'd been driving track days for a while, so I thought, I've got a bit of a chance here.
Yeah.
And just got massively overexcited in the first race. There was three races.
Yeah.
I think I qualified third, and I went off into the gravel. So you start where you finish in the next race. So I started at the back of the grid in the second race.
Yeah.
Fought my way through to about fifth, I think, in the 20 minutes. And then the final race, I got from fifth to second. So I didn't actually win, but I got to second. So.
You got on a podium in your first race weekend.
Yeah, it was, so that was my first race. But first proper race, I would say, is it was the Radical SR1 Cup. And that was a few months later. Yeah, exactly. And I was just very lucky because I was filming a documentary for the BBC about Colin McRae, who we'll probably get on to chat about later on, who was one of my greatest motorsport hero. And it was through that filming, we were doing a set-up track day at Alton Park, and Roger Green was there, who I recognised immediately from Evo. I was like, are you Roger Green from Evo? And he said, look, we've got this, are you interested in racing? We've got this series next year, novice race series, SR1 Cup. Everyone's a beginner, and we can get you your license, and we can get you a bit of tuition.
Sure.
So my first driving instructor was Andy Wallace.
Wow, that's not a bad person to have.
I mean, what a lucky boy I am. So yeah, I raced in the SR1 Cup. And you mentioned London 2012 and big sporting moments where you've got to deal with pressure, but honestly, I don't care who you are, what you've done previously. That first experience, rolling onto the grid,
sat on the grid,
shaking like a leaf.
Did you get that feeling that I got? In fact, I still get it sometimes. Is that there's not a single place in the world you wouldn't rather be.
Exactly. You're thinking. I think it's the danger combined with the lack of experience and your lack of even just little things, not knowing what's going on in the flat. When the 30 seconds to go board goes up, or the 5 minute to go and the green flag lap, and wait a minute, is this the real race, or is this the warm-up lap, or is it, all these things that you understand, you take for granted once you're experienced. The first time you do it, you've been told what's happening, but all these things fly at your head because you're trying to focus on not stalling it coming off the start line. But yeah, I was terrified, absolutely loved it, and I think I came sixth or fifth or something, but just that feeling of adrenaline at the end of the race, jumping out the car and laughing and talking at 100 miles an hour to your
and did you know racers. In that moment that you were going to be racing in one form or another for
because I'm in a very fortunate position that this race seat was given to me, offered to me, you never take anything for granted, and it's
but you've been bitten by the bug.
Oh, 100%. And people would say, was this designed to replace cycling or give you, to just fill that hole in your life when you've retired from one thing? But it wasn't. It was just, I don't know, it just kind of happened organically where you find something that you love and the opportunity comes along and it grows legs and you become obsessed by it and it's all you think about. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. Did the full season in the SR1 Cup, got to the end of that year, and then Nissan came on board. They were going to become an Olympic partner for Rio in 2016. They were looking for an ambassador for that relationship and a mentor for their athletes. And the trouble was I kind of didn't want to be tied down to one manufacturer, thinking, well, I like doing motorsport. I don't want to miss out on racing. And I said, can I still race in other cars? He said, well, we'd like you to be in our car, but you could potentially race in a Nissan and we'll get you on track and see what you're like on track. I did a test at Silverstone. And they said, we think we can get you to Le Mans in 3 years within the time frame of this contract.
Okay.
And I thought, well, it's a bit optimistic. That's not going to happen. But, at least I can maybe do the British GT series or something else. And it all kind of started from there.
Well, we'll get on to all of that in a minute. So, first crash, we've got to do it.
First crash. So I passed my test in 1996. And my first crash was in 2010 possibly at Alton Park. So I had a Lotus 211.
Yeah.
It was my second kind of serious track car. I had a Caterham R400 before that. I sold the Caterham, got this Lotus, and it was November. It was dry, but it was about 2 degrees. And I came into before the hairpin, what's left hand corner, Island Bend.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. And what was it the proper island, but the quick one.
Yeah, the fast one. So it was in that car. It was a gentle, just a brush of the brakes, and then in, and it's, you know, Lotus classic sort of Lotus weight distribution.
Yeah.
I realised I was going a bit too hot. Lifted the back end, started to come, caught it.
Yeah.
Thought I caught it, and then it just snapped, and I went into the barrier. But the thing that made it even worse was that about 10 minutes before, I'd been out all day, no problem at all. About 10 minutes before I went out for that last run, one of the instructors came over, young lad, he was doing the Carrera Cup, you know, professional driver. He said, "Do you want me to come and give you some tuition?" And I was like, "Oh, that'd be amazing, yeah, thanks very much." So he hopped in the car, like the third lap, we're at the tyre wall, and then... I remember he was just in his jeans and sort of normal clothes and stuff with his helmet on, but when he took his helmet off, we'd gone into the barrier with all the mud in the tyre wall. It had gone up inside his helmet, and I thought it was blood on his face at first, and I was like, "Oh my God." He's like, "Oh no, it's just mud." But yeah, the car was in a bit of a state, and I got it all repaired, and then, you know, it was like, that was the point, that was the question that I had to ask myself, right, this is a serious thing. It's not, you know, you're not mucking around here. Yeah. You could really hurt yourself, other people.
It can go wrong.
Do you want to do this?
Yeah.
You realise there are pros and cons to doing this. And it took a while to get back on the horse. But yeah, I think that was the point. I thought, yeah, do you know what? It's a risk I'm willing to take because, you know, life is boring without calculated risks, I think.
So one of the things we're here to do today is to talk about your favourite cars. And we're going to try and get through six of them. Mm-hmm. So what's the first one?
Favorite cars of all time that I've driven, or this is going to be heavily race car.
That's fine.
Weighted, I'm afraid. First one would be the car that I drove, the first LMP2 car that I drove. It was a Greaves Motorsport Gibson LMP2 2015. It was at the end of my first season racing in European Le Mans series, and this was with a view towards driving this car in Le Mans at the 24-hour race the following year. And this car had won the LMP2 category at Le Mans. It had you know, considerable success, and it was about the third or fourth year it'd been running, and Greaves Motorsport, a serious team, and it was, we dashed out to Estoril, we got stuck in, there was storms and various things, different airports, eventually got there for the second half of the day, and it was wet, but I'll never forget driving it, and just, even in tricky conditions, how friendly a car it was, and how exciting it was. It was just, to me, like it was the best race car I've ever driven, and also with the prospect of this could be the car that you race the 24 Hours of Le Mans in, it was just a really special day and a special car. It was an open top cockpit one, not one of the closed ones that they have now, so the visibility was great. The balance, everything about it, the setup was just, it was perfect, and that is the best race car that I've experienced so far.
Okay, so let's just wind the clock back a little bit. So I'm guessing when you were a kid, you weren't sitting there like I think most of us thinking all I want to be in life is a racing driver, or were you?
Well, I before I really got obsessed with bikes, cars, toy cars, Skeletrics, that was my thing.
Okay.
I had a 24 Hours of Le Mans Skeletric set with the Porsche 911s with the headlights that came on, the gold and the silver ones.
Wow.
And that was the first time I became aware of Le Mans, and that, you know, just, it wasn't even on your radar, the thought that you could even do that. You know, I think other sports seem more accessible.
Yeah.
But I was interested in it and aware of it. And I loved cars, but I never thought motorsport would be even a thing to aspire to.
No.
It just seemed so far off the radar.
Yeah. So were you always equally into cycling?
Well, I watched the film E.T. and saw a BMX bike when I was 6 or 7, and I'd never seen a BMX before, and it was just a totally different way to use a bike, you know, going over jumps and carving through the bank berms and stuff, and it was just, I want to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess you, as a child, or when you're young, it can just be one sudden thing, one moment, one experience that you just go, that's it, that's what I'm interested in.
And did you know, or did someone tell you, pretty early on that you had a special capacity, ability
no,
for doing this?
No, absolutely not. I wasn't one of those kids that you would have picked out in the team or in your class or whatever that would have been, he's going to be a champion in the future. Yeah. because there were you know, in every sports team I ever took part in, there was always one person that you thought would play for their country or would, you know, make it to a professional level. And I wasn't one of those people, and it was, but I was good at sport, but I wasn't great. And I think that the key thing that I learned was the correlation between hard work and success. And, you know, even at a young age, it was, I knew that if I wanted to make the team, I had to work hard. I knew if I, you know, I was the kicker for our rugby team, and I used to practice for hours. I would, you know, I would stay after training on, and I'd kick 100 balls, and I would go into the park when I didn't have to on my own and just practice my kicking. And
so is that something that is kind of like innate to you? Is that just part of the makeup of your character, or is that just something that you recognised you needed to do?
I don't know. I think at the heart of it is enjoyment. You've got to got to love what you do. You know, you work harder at things that you enjoy. So I knew that working hard at school would get me good grades, and then, you know, you get to university and you get a good job, and it's, this is drummed into you from, you know, the age of whatever. But that didn't mean to say I worked hard at school, because I didn't love, I wasn't driven to work hard, because I didn't enjoy, well, I did enjoy some of the subjects, but I wasn't massively motivated to do that. But when you find something you love, then you will do it until you're absolutely exhausted. You'll kick 1,000 balls, you'll ride on your bike until you're exhausted, you'll go the extra mile. So I think I realised I wasn't one of those kids that would just pick up a ball and score goals or be amazing at rugby or, but I was good, but I wasn't, you know, exceptional.
So when did you decide to make cycling your life?
Very late on, because it was never going to be a viable career option. There was no, the British Cycling Federation was there were two full-time members of staff, and that was it, you know, back in the early 90s. Yeah. I rode my first, I represented GB for the first time in 1996 in Manchester at the World Championships. And for that race, you race on your own bike, but they loan you these wheels, race wheels, and you get loaned a tracksuit top for the week. So you sign out this tracksuit, this grubby old second-hand tracksuit.
Which you have to give back again.
Which you have to get back at the end. And you get given two race suits for the season. And if you crash and you put a hole in it, then you've got one. You know, that was just the way it was. So you think, you know, I used to bore the pants off my young teammates back in the day when you would tell them about the old stories of, you know, what it used to be like when it was very, very amateurish. But I'm glad that I had that experience, because then you appreciate when you do get the support and you do get the equipment and you do get, you know, I remember the first race I turned up and the mechanic had assembled my bike for me, because you travel with your bike in a bike box and you put it together and you always do that yourself. And then the first race, when someone did it for you, you turned up and it's there and it's got the warm-up gear on it already and everything, tires are pumped up, and you're like, this is amazing. Yeah. So you appreciate it. I think if you've, and that's nothing against this modern or the you know, the younger generation of riders, because it's all they've ever known. But I appreciated what I had. I did it because I loved it. And then it became a career later on. So I was probably 24 before I thought this is something that I could actually.
And I'm guessing that's quite old for people in that sport.
There's a lot of folk retiring by the time
they're 24. Makes me wonder how much more you could have won if you decided.
Well, I think it elongated my career, because I didn't burn out at a young age. There wasn't as much pressure. Like the younger riders now have huge pressure to perform immediately, straight out the box. You know, you're 19 years of age. If you're representing GB, you're going to have to perform. Otherwise, someone else will come and take your place. So in the early years, there just wasn't that competition or expectation. All you had to be was the best in the country, and you got the jersey and you got to compete. I learned from a young age that if you work hard, you'll improve. And I was competitive. I was the kind of kid that had to win at Monopoly with my sister and whatever it was I wanted to win. So I was driven. But I think that's just who I am.
And did you, you know, right the way through your career, because I can't even begin to imagine the sacrifices you must have had to make to do all that you did you always love it? Or were there times when you just thought, I just can't be done with this, it's just too much?
You can gloss over the bits, the tough bits and the bits where you want to quit and the bits where you're not enjoying it, and the fact that every day you wake up and get out of bed and your body aches. You know, the only time your body doesn't ache is during that last 2 or 3 weeks before the Olympics or the World Championships, where you start to taper down the volume of training and you're resting up.
Yeah.
Because you're always training so hard that your body is kind of suppressed. It's in that fine line between being overtrained and being undertrained. So you only improve if you keep creating a stimulus that the body has to adapt to.
Yeah.
So you have to push all the time. It's not about that one day every 4 years. It's about a wet Wednesday afternoon when nobody's there to cheer you on and watch you. You get the grind done. You've got to be self-motivated. You don't have to have a coach standing over you shouting at you, telling you what to do.
Yeah.
That comes from within. That voice is within. But at the core of it, it's because you love it. So you don't love every moment. You don't love the pain you go through in every training session. But I love the feeling at the end of the day, knowing that I'd truly done everything I could that day to improve and to take a step closer to that goal. And yeah, some of the most satisfying feelings when you've finished a training session, you're on your way home and you've done a personal best in the gym or for a peak power output for in training, something that means nothing really, but to you, you know, you've taken that, you've raised your bar a little bit personally, and nobody saw it, nobody knew about it apart from your coach and your teammates. But it's a really, you have that feeling of optimism and you think, you know, this could be on, this could be a good season.
And did you always know when you were going to stop?
I stopped in 2013 after London. So London was the big carrot that kept me going. I was 36 in London, which is ancient for a track sprinter. And it was a tough couple of years leading up to London because my body was just breaking down, basically. It wasn't handling the training. The recovery was a real challenge.
And but did you still feel that you were able to maintain that level? You were as good as you'd ever be?
One-off efforts, yeah. So I could still see the data, and it was very data-driven.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like I think if you play a team sport, if you play football, you can sort of think, well, do you know what? As long as you can produce a bit of magic three or four times in the match, then you can carry yourself through it. But there's nowhere to hide, you know, when it's just you and the track and the stopwatch. So I could hit the numbers and I was still at my best, but what I wasn't at my best for was doing repeated efforts, doing race after race, 5 days in a row of racing. And I think that's partly why they only picked me for the Kieran and not the sprint.
Yeah.
So I did one individual event and the team event.
Yeah.
The team event was in the first day, 3 days recovery, and then the final day was the Kieran. So it worked perfectly. But yeah, there was the option to try and continue on for two more years to 2014 for the Commonwealth Games. We're in Glasgow, and that would have been...
And I seem to remember you talking about that. I mean, you did talk about doing that, didn't you?
I did. Well, it would have been... I mean, it's a bit greedy, but it would have been amazing to have two home games to finish your career off. But I realised... I got back into training, and it was just... My heart wasn't in it. My body wasn't really up to the challenge. And I thought, do you know what? There's more to life. And it was nice to be able to retire at the point when you choose. So it's always that feeling of one more race, like boxers, one more fight.
Yeah.
And then you look back and you think, oh, it would have been nice to finish with that memory of the greatest moment in your career as your last big race. But it was tough, but your life changes. And, you know, I became a father and, you know, you have a whole different perspective when that happens. I'd focused on one thing to the nth degree for so many years. Now was the chance to have a bit of balance in my life and a bit of variety, and motorsport was part of that. So motorsport gave me that. You know, I think a lot of people struggle when they finish being super competitive and they've been at the top of their game. You need to have an outlet for that energy, or I certainly do. And motorsport filled that gap. But it is a tough time when you retire, when you've been doing one thing for so long. And also, normally retirement happens when you're getting to your 60s and you know, and you face your mortality then. I think, you know, when you're getting a bit older and you start realizing, you're looking back and looking forward, but we're doing that in your 30s, it's quite a strange feeling. So you try and find new challenges.
Let's get another car in quickly.
Yeah, sorry, enough bikes.
No, we're going to go back. We need to talk about London 2012
another
just
car
for a minute. But let's just drop another car in before.
Do you know what? The favourite car that I've ever owned, and I still got it, and I can't see myself selling it unless I have to at some stage, a 911 GT3 RS 991, second gen, Visac pack.
Wow.
Magnesium wheels, you know, the full shebang. And it's set up. It's got the Manti.
You've got
it. Yeah, it's got the KW suspension. So I got that pretty much straight off the back. So it's got this. It's not got the aero package, but it's got the suspension.
Yeah.
It's got this. The surface transform ceramic discs on it, brake lines, what else have we done? The JCR exhaust on the back. I've done it exactly how I like it, and I use it as a track day car, which is, you know, it's way too much for a regular track day car. You don't need that kind of performance, but it's the closest thing that I've found. What I love about it is that you could drive to Spa, do a track day and drive home, and it'll do everything to an amazing level. In fact, I drove a GT2 RS, it was a Porsche GB's own one.
Yeah.
to Spa, did the GT2 RS Club Sport race, the first ever GT2 RS Club Sport race a couple of years ago in Spa against all the other GT2 RSs and the 935.
Of course.
And drove there and back in this GT2 RS. And it was the most incredible demonstration of what the 911 platform can do.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
And it's such a cliche, and everybody raves about them. It put me off them for so long. I resisted the urge to drive the modern 911.
Because people have been banging on about them for decades.
And then you go, it's like the first corner, you kind of go, oh, I get it now. Yeah, fair enough. So that is my dream car. And you've already got it. I've already got it. I've done about 11,000 miles.
You're not precious about the miles.
I drive it all year round. You know, it was track day a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. Snetterton and Donington here as well. So yeah, it is my dream car, and I love what it can do, and I love the fact that you can put it along, you know, on the road and take it easy, or you can go do your shopping in it, or you can set a lap time at Spa.
Okay, so London 2012. Completely different to any other Olympics you'd been to?
Yeah, completely different. And, you know, I've been to Sydney, Athens, Beijing prior to London. And so you feel as if you've seen it and done it before. Yeah. But nothing prepares you for that moment when you step onto the track and they announce the home rider. And the roar, the noise was unbelievable. And there's two ways of dealing with it. You either go, oh my God, and your legs turn to jelly, or you feel the energy and you think, this is an opportunity. This is my chance to shine. This is the reward for all the hard work. This is not a weight on your shoulders. And I used that energy and I loved it. And it was, there's not many moments in my life that I would want to keep returning. There's loads of moments I'd love to go back to in my life, but there's not many that would rank alongside that feeling of when you step on the track. And then when you cross the line first and you hear that, the crowd went absolutely wild, and you sit right up the track and you get really close to the fans and you just see faces and you can see the energy they've got. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things I miss from the time, was that moment, the seconds after you cross the finishing line and the crowd responds. It's just, it is a drug. It's addictive, that feeling.
Yeah. So when you did say goodbye, are you one of these guys who can just walk away and shut the door and move on? Or did you struggle with it at all?
I did struggle, particularly after going to Rio and Glasgow in 2014 as well. I was working with the BBC and had a little studio on the side of the velodrome looking down onto the track. And you walk into the velodrome and it's that feeling of half an hour before the start of the race when all the crowd are settling in and you see all the teams warming up in the track centre, and you see there's your coaches, there's your teammates, and they're warming up, and you suddenly think, oh God, I should be down there. You know what, where's my bag, where's my kit?
Yeah.
And you feel like almost guilty that I should be out there. You know, what am I doing up here chatting away, you know, with Claire Balding? I should be in the track centre getting ready to go. And it's, I guess the good sign I think is that I still ride my bike whenever I can. I still go to the gym, I still enjoy riding, you know, that I still enjoy the part of the sport that a lot of people give up straight away, so they hate the training, and that's a necessary evil.
Do you do any sort of riding events? I mean, maybe not sort of races, but do you just go and ride by yourself?
I don't race, no, but I do. Have you heard of Zwift? It's like an online virtual platform, so you log on, you ride, you know, your indoor turbo trainer. And then I could log in at the same time as you and go, right, Andrew, do you want to ride together here? And you've got your power outputs, and you put in your weight and your height, and it gives a rough estimation of your drag coefficient. And then it's got your power meter, and it reacts to the hill, so you can see the route in front of you. And as you hit the hill, it adds a resistance to the machine, so it does replicate cycling in the real world. So you can actually race or ride against with other people, and that's the only place I've actually done any kind of competitive stuff over the last few years, just for fun. But they had a race last year where they had all kinds of guests, and it was like a staggered sort of handicap start. They had people like, who did they have? Mel C from the Spice Girls. They had Paula Radcliffe, James Cracknell, The Roar. They had a few other sort of celebrities out there, and then they had serious, you know, cycling, like Tour de France winners, Alberto Contador. They had Johnny Brownlee, or Alistair Brownlee, and a few other amazing triathletes. Anyway, so they had us all staggered in that, and it was, and that's not my forte. It was basically racing up a hill for an hour. You know, I used to race for a minute maximum, and even up a hill as well. I'm 90 odd kilos, and these guys can be, you know, 58, 59 kilos. Yeah. So, but still, that competitive instinct.
You still got it.
And I ended up on the sprint, a match sprint at the end with Alberto Contador, who's a Tour de France winner. At the top of a mountain. So yeah, you know, there's some parts of your brain you can't switch off. It's still competitive.
Brilliant. I think we ought to do another car.
Yeah, another car. Do you know what? This is probably quite a controversial one, because I was going to pick between one or two cars. It's Rallycross. So I've tried Rallycross the last few years. One of my favourite experiences in motorsport. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
I did a programme for... It was a series called Dream Jobs, where I got to try different forms of motorsport, different cars. And one of the first thing we did was Rallycross. And it was one day of testing at Pembrey and then straight in the deep end with a World Rallycross Championship against Timmy Hansen and Nicholas Grönholm and all these guys at Barcelona. So I turned up, you know, first heat, and it's a random draw for the first heat. And literally it was this stacked heat with all the big names, and you're holding the handbrake and there's this... The anti-lag's popping and banging, and you've got 600 horsepower under your foot, and it's utterly terrifying. But one of the, and I think because it's so condensed and so short and such a sprint, that it almost, it sort of resonates with me in my previous life as a track sprinter, that you can win it on the first corner, as opposed to in motorsport, that's the golden rule. You know, don't risk it on the first corner. Well, you do in rallycross, and it's all about the timing and the start, and it's, you know, door handle to door handle. So I loved that whole experience. And I was going to pick that car, which is a Fiesta supercar. But this is the electric rallycross car, run by Team Starred, which I tested at Lyddon Hill at the beginning of last year. And I thought, I'm going to be impressed by it as a tool.
Yeah.
It's going to be...
You're going to admire it,
yeah, exactly. Like all electric cars I've driven so far, you come away going, wow, that's incredible what they've done.
Yeah.
But at no point is it pulling your heartstrings and make you want to get your checkbook out and actually buy it. And it was the opposite with this. So I got in and I drove it, and I thought I'd miss the noise. And don't get me wrong, the drama of these rallycross cars, the combustion engine ones, are incredible.
But I guess there's still transmission noise.
Exactly. And once you get going, the noise, the gravel hitting the wheel arches and everything else going on, you don't actually, you're not aware of it when you're racing. But the control that you have with all that torque, instantaneous torque, to be able to adjust the angle of the car through the gravel, through the slippy sections, it handled, for a heavier car, it was heavier than the regular one, but I actually had way more fun in that car. And because as an amateur as well, not having to worry about the gears and everything else, you're purely focusing on throttle control.
Yeah.
And the brake, and then your steering input.
How much power?
It was about the same, about 600 horsepower, but the torque was way more.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't just me. So I came out grinning like a Cheshire cat and raving about it, full of adrenaline. And they were interviewing me afterwards, saying, what do you think of the car? And I was, raving about it. But then Matt Neal was there as well that day. And Liam Doran was there as well, who, you know, he was in his regular car. And they both got in and tested the car as well. And Matt Neal said, when can I race this? You know, this is absolutely... He was grinning ear to ear as well. And then Liam Doran got out and said, well, if I'm going to do the Five Nations Championship next year, I want to do it in this car. That's how much. And when he was, you know, you've been to Lyddon, I guess. So, you know, whatever that corner at the bottom, the right-handers, you come down the hill from the tarmac onto the gravel. I mean, it's one of the most spectacular things I've seen in motorsport, is Liam Doran coming down there, backing it in. And in that electric rallycross car, it was just absolutely spectacular. So I was, you know, I, like everybody else, all the kind of petrol heads into motorsport, a little bit doom and gloom about the future and what's it going to hold and what's it going to look like and sound like. And for me, if it's anything like that, then it's not going to be all that bad after all.
So let's go back to your road to Le Mans. You talked about Nissan saying, well, 3 years' time, we can get you there. Did you just think, that's impossible?
I thought, well, that's ridiculous, because, you know, I'm driving around in SR1, radical SR1s against, you know, other middle-aged blokes. How on earth will I be able to handle the step up to get faster, first of all, but also just to deal with the safety of it all and the danger of it all? And it just seemed like such a huge chasm from where I was to where I wanted to be. But the one thing that gave me hope was that that was what they were doing at that time with GT Academy. So they're getting kids from a PlayStation who had never even driven a real live race car before.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And then making that transition. So Jan Mardenborough,
absolutely.
Lucas O'Donnez, yeah. You know, numerous other drivers who had done that very successfully to the podium. So they were great, and we did lots of simulator work. We did lots of testing and track work, and yeah, it's so much help from the guys. Really, really helped. And first season was a baptism of fire. British GTs had gone from racing 500 kilogram, you know, 200 horsepower radicals to being in a GT3, a Nissan GTR GT3, run with Bob Neville's RGN team, and it was so my teammates. Al Buncombe,
yeah.
Jan Mardenborough,
Wolfgang
Ripe, who else did I drive with that year? But yeah, it was amazing to learn.
So, I mean, that's a serious level.
Yeah, the first race is Alton Park and this massive big GTR. I think we came ninth, and that was when the GT3 field was much bigger than GT4. It's kind of gone the other way now, but back then it was. So we got top 10, got some points, and then it all started to, we started to improve a little bit. We got fifth at the Silverstone 500 and then got to Spa. And Spa happened the week after one of the worst moments, touch wood, in my motorsport experience so far. Goodwood hill climb, driving Andy Palmer's personal Nissan Nismo GTR into the hay bale.
I wasn't going to bring that up.
I was going to tell that story with the crash, but I thought I'd tell it because the Lotus one happened before then. But yeah, it was awful. It's probably the worst place to have a crash, because if you crash in a race or a test, it's expected, really. Yeah. It's part of the sport. But you don't bin it at Goodwood because everybody sees it. Everyone talks about it. Everyone goes, what was he thinking? And I was that guy. And I slowed, you know, shut the track for half an hour while they cleared it all up. And I was just like such an idiot. And the worst thing about it was the feeling that I was in this privileged position. You get given the chance to drive these amazing cars.
Yeah.
And you just don't want to damage them. You don't want to make it look as if you're not taking it seriously. Because I did take it seriously. But equally, the reason I crashed was because I was wanting to do it justice. You don't want to just poodle up the hill and go, hello, everybody.
Yeah.
It's a fine line, though, isn't it? It is. And that's what I learned that day. You've got to tread it carefully.
Well, I would say there's particularly this fine line up that hill, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Oh, at Malcolm it is.
Yeah.
I remember that feeling of seeing the corner and thinking...
Because you probably had a while to think about it, didn't
you? I hadn't hit the brakes, but they said, if you see the corner before you brake,
you're
in trouble. And I was just like, oh, shit. So, yeah, it was a big one. Like, I think it's three rows of hay bales, or four. I got the fourth row of hay bales, which is a record. And it was Andy Palmer's car. He hadn't even driven it yet. Only two in the country.
Yeah. I bet he was gracious about it, though.
He said, you know what? Because I saw him about 10 minutes after the crash. He said, we can replace cars. We can't replace people. You're in one piece. He said, it's getting great publicity. So, you know, there's every cloud. And I was like, what an amazing guy. And Andy's a top bloke. And we kept in touch when he went on to Aston as well. We raced together in a GT4 Aston at Spa in the 12-hour. This is a very long way of getting round to the story about got to Spa the week after that big crash.
Yeah.
Never been to Spa before, and it was wet, and there was problems with the car. Yeah. So we didn't get much running. I think I'd done about 5 or 6 laps in the wet. And I was just thinking, this is just not for me. It's not going to happen. You know, I've bitten off more than I can chew. Being in the public eye as well, because it was quite publicised, I was going to make this challenge to try and get to Le Mans. And you feel like a bit of a numpty, and you're thinking, well, why did I not keep my mouth shut and try and build up steadily and do it in 10 years or whatever? But we got to the race and had a dream race. So Wolfie got an amazing start. Handed over to me in the lead, and then I held it I came out the pits, and there was Marco Attard, I think it was, BMW Z4. He was right behind me, and I had Bob on the radio saying, Chris, let him pass when you can, let him pass. And I thought, I must have had some sort of penalty when, you know, the release in the pit lane or something I'd done wrong, or just swapped places. So I let him through, and then followed him through the last 10 minutes, stuck with him, couldn't get past him, but came second, got on the podium. And at the end, I remember I said to him, so what was the reason we had to swap places? He goes, I just didn't want you to tangle and crash.
Oh, no.
And I was like, we could have won the race.
And you could follow him easily, so you would have been...
I think I could have held him off. Well, it's easy to say that now. But anyway, it was... you know, we got a trophy, made the podium. It was my first ever podium in motorsport at Spa in the British GT Championship. So what an experience. And that was really the first point I thought maybe this could be. It had gone from the start of the week being the depths of depression and doom and gloom to thinking this could be on.
Okay, let's do another car.
Another car. It's a tough one. I think I've driven one of these cars, or a few of these cars, at Goodwood at the Revival, and it's the car that, just in general, Minis are a kind of car that resonate with me.
Yeah.
My grandpa had one. He used to take us to school in it sometimes, and the fact that you get into an old Mini and the smell, they all smell the same. There's something about the interior that the smell is distinctively Mini, and it immediately brings you back to being in my grandpa's car. And I'm having a little tin of sweets that you'd, you know, hand you a sweet.
The travel sweets. Yeah,
which seem to have disappeared these days. That was the thing. I raced in 2013 at the Revival in one, and I raced last year in one as well. And there's just something about the Mini. It's something about the underdog, the little, you know, underweighted, underpowered, that can punch way above its weight.
Yeah.
Just the driving experience, the fact you just chuck it in.
They're completely different. They require, you have to drive them a completely different way, don't you?
I mean, I didn't get any testing in it last year before the race, and my first lap was in qualifying at Goodwood. Yeah. And I remember going into the first corner and just thinking, uh-oh, I'm going to hit the wall here, because I'm just, the all four wheels sliding.
Yeah.
I hadn't turned in early enough, and I just kept it on the tarmac before touching the grass. And you know how fast the first corner at Goodwood is. So it kind of woke me up a little bit. And they look little friendly cars, but if you get them wrong, you're going to be in a big one, a big accident. But no, it's just everything about it. It puts a smile on your face. People smile at you when you're driving them. The fact they're the underdog, the fact that they punch above their weight, the fact that it's just a fun car and almost any speed to drive. Yeah. So yeah, a 1965 Cooper S.
Lovely.
Mini, that'll do it for me.
Okay, so you've done GT3. When was the first time you got in a prototype? Because you did a lot of P3, didn't you?
Yeah, the first LMP car was the Ginetta LMP3, and they were the first guys to develop an LMP3 as a new category.
Yeah.
And that was at the start of 2015. So they were going to be part of the European Le Mans series. We went out to, the first time I drove it was at Paul Ricard, and it was a day and night test. And we went out, and the car was still in very early development, so it was still a bit rough around the edges. And for me, I was super intimidated by it, this big, loud V8, this kind of getting into the cockpit of an LMP car.
Yeah.
When the lid shuts down next to your helmet and you're in this really tight, confined
space. Particularly
through
a big lad, it's quite.
Oh. And they hadn't, the trouble was they designed the tub without the safety, what do they call it, around the head harness thing. So they designed it to fit, and then they suddenly said, here's the head support to go around the back. And they basically wedged it in, so it meant that my chin was touching my chest virtually. So I was in this terrible position I was sitting in, didn't feel comfortable. It was a scary car, it was still a bit rough around the edges, and I was just like, oh my God, I'm out of my depth here again. But Mike Simpson, Charlie Robertson, brilliant pro drivers who got me through it, helped me, you know, gave me the confidence. I started to push on a bit, got to grips with it, starting to feel quite happy with it. And then the sun went down, and I was the first to go out for the night session. And that's, you know, Paul Ricard's light, there's very few reference points.
And were you using the full circuit?
Full circuit, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So you're turning in at the end of, you know, the long straight.
It's a scene, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and it's like, well, yeah, it could be flat, might not be flat, have a go. And you're kind of like, I can tell you now, it's not going to be flat. And yeah, there's very few reference points. You can't really see where you are in the daytime, let alone at night. So got out there, drove around, got completely lost, just felt completely, I did like two or three laps, and I thought, if this is what Le Mans is going to be like, then it's not going to happen, because I just can't do this. You know, I don't know how they do it, but it's bloody awful. You can't see anything. And I'm lost, I don't know where I'm going, I can't see the reference points. I came in and I said to Mike, I'm sorry, I was really struggling. He goes, that's okay, it's your first experience of it. It takes time for the eyes to adapt and to find new reference points.
Yeah.
So he gets in the car, he did one lap, straight back in. Yeah, the lights aren't working. And I was like, all right, that kind of explains it. So yeah, the lights were fixed and I could see where I was going. But because I had no experience, I thought,
of course,
that's
you
just
don't,
what
you
it
don't
is.
Know,
yeah,
do you?
Yeah. So you don't know what you don't know. And Yeah, it was a fantastic season. We went on to win the, with Charlie Robertson and myself, we won the LMP3 category. I got to drive at Le Mans in the test day. So LMP3 cars were allowed in the test.
I remember, yeah.
So I got my first experience of driving at Lasarth and yeah. You know, that feeling of pulling out the pit lane, you know, thinking, well, even if I don't make it next year to the 24 hours, I've driven the circuit.
You've driven the circuit.
How many people get the chance? It's not like Silverstone or Donington or wherever.
Yeah, where you can just go and do a track day. Yeah.
So it was, you know, so much to thank Ginetta for, an amazing group of people, great team spirit, and yeah, that LMP3 car to win my only ever championship so far, it was in that car.
Okay, let's do another car.
How many have we had so far?
We've had four.
Four so far, right, okay, I know this is a bit boring, I'm sorry, and I know that everybody would say it, and it's very predictable, but a Singer 911 as my dream car. So I've not driven it. This is the one that if I had the money, if I had the, you know, the opportunity to drive to have one, it would be, you know, and I know that, yeah, it's a bit of a cliche just now. Everyone's into them, but I've always.
Yeah, but there's a reason for that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'll have driven one.
I haven't.
You've not driven one?
No, I haven't. No.
Well, it's yeah.
No, I mean, both know people who have, but no,
I've seen them up close and I've heard them, and you know, I think it would be. Yeah, I'd spend, I think part of the fun is just the specking of it and taking the time to pour over the detail and to get it exactly the way you want, and it would be a forever car, and it would be something that, yeah, to keep enjoying that purity of a road car that you can enjoy that's not ridiculously powerful. I probably wouldn't go for the DLS one, I'd probably go for the standard one. Yeah. And just, yeah, I love 911s and air-cooled 911s, but with all the benefits of modern technology, but still with a bit of soul from the old days. That would be my dream car, I suppose.
So Le Mans itself, I was there. I think you did a triple stint in the night, didn't you?
Yeah.
And I can remember standing on the bank, watching you do that and thinking, actually, that really is something. Someone you'd never raced there before in a P2 car. So not a sort of, what do they call it? GTM or whatever. It was a proper thing.
Yeah.
So just tell us a bit about the experience of not just driving around that circuit, but racing at Le Mans, race day. And I mean, was that something which there'd been a time you thought you might never get to do?
Yeah, there were loads of times where I thought it might not happen. So at the end of 2015, when the whole Nissan LMP1 project went, you know, kaput.
Oh, of course, with the GTR Nismo.
Yeah, yes. So there was all kinds of, you know, the budgets were frozen, so Japan was taking control over what's happening with the money. And
yeah.
And all of a sudden it was like, well, you know, well, we've got a contract and, you know, Le Mans is supposed to be on, but nothing was guaranteed. And it had to be in a car that had a Nissan engine,
yeah,
obviously. But the number of cars that had Nissan engines and seats available were starting to get filled up.
Yeah.
But the money wasn't freed up from Japan to say, yes, you can spend it on this project.
Yeah.
So there were seats available at Greaves, had a chance to drive for Greaves, and that went. And then it was like, you know, the number of options were getting less and less. And I think we had two options left, and one of them was Algarve Pro Racing, who were, you know, at that stage, a fairly inexperienced team. It was a rookie team for Le Mans. Yeah. And yeah, I turned up and it was a Ligier LMP2. But yeah, getting, you know, we drove that season with them, with Michael Muniman and Andrea Pizzatola. And it was, yeah, it's a cliche to say, but it was everything I expected or I hoped it would be and more. It, you know, everything about it was special. And often these things that you build up in your head turn out not to live up to your expectations, yeah. But it didn't. It was the opposite. And because you're aware of how precarious motorsport is, so there was a guy in the GT Academy from Nissan who the year before, he'd won GT Academy and he was getting a drive with Greaves, Gaetan Paletou, French driver, and he was a great driver, but he was the second guy to go, and the driver before him crashed in the wall and that was their race over, so he never actually got to drive at Le Mans, and that was his one year, he didn't get another chance.
Yeah.
And he probably never, well, he might get another chance at some point, yeah. But you know, that was his opportunity. So, and he was absolutely devastated. So you're always thinking, you know, you can't take anything for granted. You're not thinking about winning the race. You're not thinking about finishing the race. You're not thinking about anything other than, I just want to get a lap on the track. I just want to experience it, first of all. Once you've done that, or you get, I want to finish the stint, and then
yeah, when
you just
want to get the car back in the right
and
condition.
Then you know, I'm not thinking about the finishing now. I'm thinking about the next stint and hoping that I'm going to get another drive, and I'm going to experience racing at night. And then, you know, it's just one step at a time. You never think too far
ahead.
Did you find
it scary? I mean, that's a scary old circuit. I mean, I've raced there, but only in historics.
It's terrifying.
And
yeah.
I've been thundering along at 2 a.m. And it's,
you know what it's like then, yeah. It's unique.
But it's a very different experience because I was in something from 50 years back, but nevertheless.
But in many ways, that can be more scary because...
We're going a lot slower.
You know, well, it's slower, but, you know, the confidence in what the machinery may or may not do when you get to that breaking point or...
Yeah.
But anyway, it was amazing. It was absolutely... It was terrifying. It was exciting. It was just, you know, everything about it. I tried to absorb it all in and just take it in as we went along. For me, the really special part was at night, my first stint at night, pulling out of the pits and heading down the straight, and then it all goes dark. We can still see, it's quite a well-lit track, but heading out away from the stands into the relative piece of the Mulsanne straight and just thinking, this is it, you're doing it. And then you see in your mirrors, so you don't even look in your mirrors, you can just sense the light coming up from behind of an LP1 car. And they come at you so fast, and their lights are so bright, and it dazzles you. So you can't actually look at them to see where they are. You can. The road in front lights up, and then here they come. And you hold your racing line, and then these spaceships come past you. But the terrifying bit is when you don't know how many there are, because often they move in packs.
Yeah, they're hunting
two
packs,
or three together. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you think it's just one, but it could be two, or it could be three. So it's not too bad in the straight because they just come straight past you. Or coming onto a straight, the traction they get is incredible, and they just drive up. The scary part is when you're coming down towards the Porsche curves and they have to get in front of you before that, because they're going to have to drive offline if not, and they're going to pick up and it's going to slow them down massively. So they will do anything they can to get in front of you before you turn in for that right-hander. And it happened a few times, absolutely terrifying. And you throw in the mix of all the GT cars that you're trying to get past. And the Ford GT, that was the year when the Ford GT won Le Mans.
Yeah.
And they were super quick in a straight line. So it wasn't like you can just breeze past them. The current LMP2s are a lot faster than the ones that I was in. So it was a battle to get past some of the pro drivers in the fast GT cars.
Yeah.
You're trying to get in front of them before the start of the Porsche curve for the same reason.
Yeah.
And the P1s are behind you doing the same. So it's terrifying. You're constantly reminded of the danger of the race with the differentials of speed for the different categories. The differentials in ability from guys like me up to the former F1 drivers. You know, Mark Webber was there that year.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference if you look at all the different factors. So you never let yourself become complacent. You never think too far ahead. You're only ever thinking about the next breaking point, the next apex, the next throttle pickup. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And the funny that, you know, you talk about a triple stint at night. It passed in the blink of an eye.
Really?
You're just,
so you weren't sort of like hanging on towards the end of the third set thing, I just got to get out of the car.
You're hanging when you get out the car, and then the adrenaline sort of wears off, and then you're like, oh my God, I've got no energy. It's the emotional energy. Physically, it's not that hard. It's the mental capacity. I'm operating at 100% just driving the car.
Yeah.
You know, the pros can operate way below their capacity, and that frees up their brain to think about other things that are going on. They can be aware of so many other factors that you can't as an amateur, because you're just still thinking about the actual weight, you know, the nature of your brake application and all these little things that are second nature to the pros. They aren't second nature to me. So it was, I'll never forget. I didn't sleep. I was drained. By the time you get to race day and race, the start of the race, you've been up late all those nights. You've had all these different events. You've had night tests. You've had qualifying. You've had the parades the night before, which doesn't finish till, you know, 10 o'clock, and it was late and all these things. So you are depleted before you start the race, and then you've got this huge emotional drain. And then at the end of it, it was the weirdest thing. I remember when Andrea was in the car, crossed the line, we finished the race, we made it across the line, we finished 12th, I think, in class, about 17th overall, all rookies. And the emotion then just comes out. Like, I never thought, why would you be getting emotional for, you know, we got to the end, that's brilliant, but it was just this.
You just finished Le Mans.
Yeah, and you suddenly realise, my God, you know, I've gone from racing SR1s at Brands Indy 3 years ago, and we've made it across the line at Le Mans. So, yeah, and I think whether I get to go back or not ever, I would love to go back, any opportunity, and you learn so much every time you go there. So I think I could do a better job next time, but even if that was my one time to do it, then I've done it.
Then you've done
I've
it.
Done it, and you know, yeah. I can look back on that with great fondness.
Wow. Okay. Last car.
Last car. I've forgotten what my last car would be. I think. Oh, yeah. I know what it is now. Again, it's not a car that I've owned, but it's the first car that my dad. I remember that my dad had. We had like a work van. He was a self-employed builder. He had this transit van. Used to go to school in that sometimes. And then one of our friends was selling this BMW, like a 2002, you know, 1970s, yeah. whatever. And it was like, you know, it's a lot of money for a car. And, you know, can we really afford it? And, you know, we bought this car from our friend. And it was a sort of cream 2002. And it was such a big deal. You know, nowadays BMWs are everywhere. They're you know, they're mass produced. There's huge volumes of them around. But back then it was quite a prestigious brand yeah, yeah. to have a yeah. badge. And I remember we're getting a BMW and just getting in it. And, you know, don't get sticky stuff on the seats and don't do this. And it was just like, wow. And so whenever you don't see them very often now. And whenever I see one, I just get this real fond memory of, you know, that car and that time. And I guess that's why, you know, I my first sort of dream car that I bought really was an E46 M3 back in about 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
And I think it's partly because of that link to BMW and the badge okay. that kind of, yeah, had that nostalgia and yeah. happy days. But yeah, I think having a couple of old classics in there, an electric rallycross car, an LMP2 car, a GT3 RS and a Singer. That's not a bad
collection. That's not a bad collection,
yeah.
is it?
Yeah.
How is life today? What keeps you busy?
Well, I guess now it's a whole collection of different things. I've got my own business making kids' bikes, yeah. so Hoy bikes, and we try and make them as light as possible, good quality components, so that there's a lot of heavy heaps of junk out there for yeah. kids that look nice but are awful to ride.
Yeah.
So the aim is to try and make it as easy as possible for kids to ride their bikes and to learn and to have fun with it. And yeah, what else am I doing aside from motorsport? I do a lot of public speaking, so yeah. you know, motivational talks, inspirational talks, hopefully. That died down a lot during the lockdown period, obviously, yeah. but it's getting back to that. We did quite a few virtual ones last year, but live events are kicking off now, so doing a fair bit of that, doing the BBC punditry for the Olympics and the World Championships. I've been involved with, well, there's a new project we're doing which I can talk about now. It's quite exciting, really. Well, for me it's exciting. Basically, it's an all-in-one unit, motor and a battery, which will clip on and will drive the disc on a bike. So any bike that's got a disc brake,
yeah.
you can convert it into an e-bike, okay. and it clips on and clips off, and it'll only be about £500-600, so you can, you know, you replace the disc for a compatible disc, you clip this thing on, ride to work on your bike, take it off, charge it up at your desk, and then wow. plug it back in. And there's going to be two versions, the kind of commuter lightweight one that will weigh about 1.8, 1.9 kilos, and then a mountain bike one that will essentially be like a chairlift that will get you up
yeah.
Ben Nevis, yeah. And you can, you know, do multiple runs.
And how long does it take to clip on and off?
About 4 seconds, three
oh,
seconds.
Really?
Yeah,
it's
amazing. And it's a guy who, the guy who came up with the idea is a guy who's, he's only in his mid-20s, he's a doctor. During the pandemic, during the start of lockdown, he came up with a new idea for a ventilator, which was then patented and then made into machines to help the NHS.
Yeah.
On top of still being a doctor during the NHS, during that pandemic, as you know, an NHS doctor, he then also came up with this idea for how it would drive the disc. He's got the patent on that. And assemble a team of people to try and make it a reality. So he's a very impressive guy, a guy called Alistair Darwood. And yeah, really, really amazing group of people that are all super enthusiastic, are bringing different skills to the group.
Yeah.
And that'll be out for sale by, hopefully by August, September this year.
Wow.
And I think it's going to convert, to be able to convert a bike into an e-bike without spending thousands of pounds on it.
And so it'd be compatible with any bike.
Any disc brake bike. And you won't have, you know, if you spend £3,000 on or more on a e-bike and you leave it outside your office chained up, you're going to be panicking that it's going to be stolen. Yeah. So you want to, you know, you can just take the motor off, put it in your back pocket, go up to your desk, and you can stick on any bike.
Can you ride it without the motor as
yeah.
well if you want
to? So, yeah. And if the battery goes flat, it's only an extra 1.8 kilos to carry. It's not like...
So you can still just pedal
home. Yeah, because the e-bikes weigh an absolute ton and they're pretty ugly and yeah, it's so expensive. So I think for many reasons, this will be something that a lot of people will get from. Because e-bikes are just a great way to allow people to that wouldn't necessarily choose to cycle the opportunity to get from A to B.
Cool. And on the racing front, we're both here today testing the Revolution.
Yes.
500 horsepower, 500 and something horsepower, I understand. Supercharged, 800 kilos. Certainly kept me busy this morning.
Oh, it's a fantastic car. I've driven the regular version, the non-supercharged version before, raced it for the last 2 years. Raced at Monza when the Formula One was on. Yeah. Raced it at Portimao when the Formula One was on. So I've had some amazing experiences in it so far. But the supercharged just seems to bring it alive. You know, the chassis can handle that power. It's, you know, you've driven it. It's not a scary animal. It's not, it doesn't feel like it's overpowered now. And the delivery of it is very progressive. So yeah, I mean, this morning was slippy and greasy and part dry, part wet. It was horrible out there, but the car dealt with it really well. So yeah, hopefully this afternoon it'll be dry and we can set some lap times.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm going to be racing in that this year in the Sports Prototype Cup. And it's a decent place to go. I think Spa, Barcelona, Paul Ricard, Zandvoort and Silverstone.
Brilliant. Okay, so this is the last thing I'm going to ask you. This is the last blast moment. You're first going to tell me where you're going to have it.
Yeah.
Then you're going to tell me who, if anyone, you'd be with.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally what you'd be in. So this is like, this is your last drive.
Okay.
And you can't drive anything after this.
Right, this is quite a personal one. Because I mentioned at the start, the person who got me into motorsport or who inspired me to be interested in motorsport, Colin McRae. In 2013, I did a documentary about his life with the BBC. Met his family, met Jimmy, you know, got to drive some amazing cars, some of his old cars. So I think, and it would be almost a replay of what I've already done, but it would be with, ideally with Colin. So a two-part drive in his car, in the Impreza, at Sweet Lamb, doing the final stage of the Rally GB, which I've driven, and I had that experience, and it was quite surreal with Derek Ringer sitting next to me.
Wow.
So I'd love to do that. And then for him to switch seats and me to go in the passenger seat and see how it's supposed to be done. I mean, that would be a last blast and a half, wouldn't it? Having Colin McRae.
Wouldn't it?
Showing you how to do it on those muddy Welsh tracks.
I'd be so scared. I wouldn't even have my eyes open.
Well, do you know what? I, whenever I've been in the passenger seat with pro drivers, I've always had this kind of belief that they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm far more
Colin
scared.
Was just like another level of craziness, wasn't it?
But that's why I think I would just love to experience, you know, for me, he's up there with some of the greatest drivers of all time.
Yeah.
You know, the Ayrton Senna is the geniuses of the sport. To watch some of the onboards from the early days, his commitment and the ability to just wring every last ounce of performance out of a car. And I think that's why he's been remembered. You know, his legend lives on. And you go to any rally now, there's still blue Imprezas with gold wheels.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, people waving the McRae flags.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's, you know, he only, inverted commas, won the one title. But you think back to people that have won multiple titles that are still remembered, of course. But there's something about Colin that resonates with rally fans and motorsport fans. And that's why, aside from being Scottish and a world champion, that's why, you know, he really appealed to me.
Brilliant. So Chris Hyde, thank you very much.
Thank you.